In the late 1970s, following the launch of new science fiction comic book 2000 AD, publishers IPC decided to develop a stablemate to cash in on its success. With longer stories, extra feature content, new ideas and glossier paper, Star-Lord launched in May 1978 with its own eponymous editor ready to do battle against the satanic forces of the Interstellar Federation. But despite its popularity among its fanbase, Star-Lord never achieved a sustainable orbit and was folded into 2000 AD after just 22 issues. But its legacy lives on, not least thanks to strips that survived the merger such as Strontium Dog and Roadbusters, which helped define 2000 AD as it went into the 1980s. We'll be interviewing 2000 AD editor and creator of Star-Lord, Kelvin Gosnell, in a future episode of the Thrillcast. And with 2018 being the 40th anniversary of its launch, we bring you a roundtable chat about the other comic of the future. With 2000 AD editor Matt Smith, Treasury of British Comics editor Keith Richardson, and on Skype, comic editor and journalist John Freeman. Don your badges and watch the sky, Star Troopers. This is Star-Lord, 40 years on. So welcome to the Thrillcast Earthlitz, and as I said in the intro, I'd like to extend a warm welcome to editors Matt Smith and Keith Richardson.
Hello.
And on Skype, comics journalist and editor John Freeman.
Hello.
So let's talk a bit about Star-Lord. It's 40 years next year since Star-Lord launched, and I thought it was an interesting time to talk about it, particularly as we have a Star-Lord print with this year's Christmas prog of 2000 AD, which is by Henry Flint. It's a little reminder of the kind of dynamism and ethos of Star-Lord almost 40 years on. Matt, explain a little bit about why we chose to honour Star-Lord in this way. Why is Star-Lord important?
The Christmas prog also features a story telling the true tale behind what Star-Lord, the editor, was actually up to. Where Star-Lord differed from Tharg is that he was galvanising his the readers into being these kind of troops for a war against an interstellar federation.
Yeah, so radicalizing young children. Then.
Yes, yeah. And there was various little factions that the young readers could join, whether it was the Skateball Strike Force or the mech engineers or the time warriors.
Sure.
And I think
the first badges, didn't they?
I was going to say the first issue came with some stickers, some badges, or transfers or something. So it's a slightly more aggressive take on getting your readership than Thal's kind of benevolent kind of welcome to thrill power.
Yeah. That was the age when comic books had fictional editors, and obviously we had Tharg, and Star-Lord had Star-Lord. Why do you think? Do you think that Tharg was an element in 2080's popularity? And if so, why do you think Star-Lord perhaps didn't galvanise people in as much?
Yeah, I think Tharg probably appealed more to the younger readers than he looked more interesting. He looked more otherworldly. Even though he was just a ape mask painted green with a brooch stuck onto him, he obviously had a character that people could enjoy. Whereas Star-Lord was just like this humanoid guy with big bouffant hair talking about this evil federation. So perhaps he didn't have that idiosyncratic quality that Tharg has that people enjoyed, but that was not to take away from the quality of the stuff that was appearing in Star-Lord, which was certainly as up there with 2000 AD at the time.
Keith, let's talk a little bit about that first launch issue. Were you a Star-Lord reader when it first came out?
I read some issues of Star-Lord. Yeah. I didn't collect it avidly. I think simply because the newsagents where I got my comics from just didn't stock it.
Right.
But I did, if I can recall, I'm sure I picked up that first issue. And I remember it being particularly more, it seemed to be more of a violent comic than 2000 AD. If you look at something like Planet of the Damned, yeah. You have people getting their faces eaten off by critters and burnt to death by acid rain, and Holocaust, you had zombies getting and people being destroyed with flamethrowers, and it was just all a bit more violent, which really should have appealed to me. I don't know why I didn't pick up it, rush out and try and get every single issue, but I certainly picked up a few.
Because, of course, that's often cited as one of the reasons for the popularity of action and 2080, well, battle as well in 2080 that followed, which is that they were more violent, they were more gritty.
Yeah.
So, I mean, by that logic, Star-Lord should have been more popular. If you're having things like Strontium Dog, which is, you know, quite a vicious kind of Western sci-fi series, and things like Mind Wars, which got fairly dark. Do you think it was just that 2000 AD merged that violence with other elements that were popular? It wasn't just that it was kind of harder.
Well, it was a little bit more po-faced as well. I say that, and then you look at Planet of the Damned. I mean, that was a laugh riot, really. But in general, it was a little bit more po-faced, I think.
Yeah.
2000 AD certainly kind of won when it came to humour. So and maybe the titles were just a little bit too similar, and it was that dark humour that kind of won through in the end.
Yeah.
And also, you know, I just the title 2000 AD to me is a lot cooler.
Mm.
You know, talk about an egomaniac. You know, the editor's got a title named after himself. That's no good. But no, I don't know. It's an odd one, but it certainly produced some fantastic strips that are still strong today, and live on within the pages of 2008.
Yeah. So. Well, we'll talk about that a bit more in a bit. John, I'd like to come to you and ask you about what you felt the impact of Star-Lord was, because obviously we've got 2000 AD, which was into its second year by this point. A year seems quite a short amount of time to launch a stablemate.
Yeah, but it's not surprising if you think about it. I mean, you think 1977, you've got Star Wars at its height, which obviously Pat Mills and co on 2000 AD is sort of like rode on the back of. I mean, for all the success of 2000 AD, the fact that Star Wars was out there and everybody was science fiction mad at that point wouldn't have done the sales any harm. So it's no wonder that IPC stroke Fleetway will be looking at doing other science fiction titles, despite saying for years that science fiction titles would never sell, which I think is something that Steve McManus has said in his book about the history of 2000 AD. But I mean, I remember buying that first issue of Star-Lord and being impressed by it, but also being a little bit wary of the fact that it was actually a little bit more pricey than 2000 AD, which could be a mitigating factor in the fact that that's one of the reasons why it wasn't the success it was, more than the actual content of the comic. And if you're thinking about pocket money prices, and that's a real driving force behind what comics you would buy at that point, when there were quite a lot of them. I mean, it's not just, you wouldn't just be buying, there wouldn't just be Star-Lord, it'd be other comics that would be rivaling for your pence, including Star Wars Weekly, of course, at that point.
What do you think Star-Lord tells us about the state of comics in the late 70s?
Well, I mean, firstly, the Star-Lord character isn't unusual in many ways at that point. He's probably the last of the calling all agents type thing that you got in TV-21 in the 1960s, for example, and Captain Hurricane in Valiant encouraging people to be his supporters or whatever. Tharg doesn't do as much of that. I mean, he just wants you to have a good time, really, doesn't he? albeit with a lot of blood and violence. But I think it's... I mean, obviously, the 1970s was still quite a lot of comics out there. There was quite a range of comics, including, of course, girls' comics as well, which, as we all know, outsold boys' comics. And from a punter's point of view, Star-Lord was just part of the mix. I follow both Star-Lord and later Tornado quite avidly, which both went through the whole 22 weeks hatch, match, and dispatch cycle of British comics that IPC did a lot of, where they would artificially try and create a title. So from a business point of view, from a company point of view, they create these titles, not necessarily with any longevity in mind, despite all the hard work of the creators involved, especially Kelvin Gosnell, but just to hopefully merge two titles, in this case, Star-Lord and 2000 AD, and boost the circulation of the surviving title. It's been something that was done with British comics for a long time. You know, you've got Lion and Valiant, and obviously Action being merged with Battle. It's not an unusual sales tactic at the time.
Do you think the fact that 2000 AD has gone on for so long has kind of, to a certain extent, warped our understanding of this period? That Star-Lord seems all too brief in comparison, and yet at the time this was a perfectly normal evolution of the newsstand.
Absolutely, and if you look at the characters that were brought into 2000 AD as a result of the Star-Lord merger, Robustus eventually and Strontium Dog, it adds to the strength and longevity of 2000 AD in that way, in terms of like strong characters. Just glancing through the covers of Star-Lord, there's nothing that really stands out in terms of a grabby character until you start having. I think you've got Strontium Dog does appear on issue one, but they're not, and he's on issue four as well, but they're not hugely standout covers until Mind Wars on issue 11, which I remember reading at the time. It's probably one of my favorite strips, but it's not like Judge Dredd, and Judge Dredd is one of those iconic characters, just like Slane and to a lesser extent the characters from Invasion, and those early it's the characters that drove the success of the comic, which other titles, rival publishers, failed to recognize. Marvel UK perhaps didn't recognize that strength that Judge Dredd had as an iconic character to attract an ongoing readership. Mm.
One thing that's really noticeable about covers, and Keith, I'll come to you on this, is that just how they're actually quite different to 2000 AD's covers. Number one, because at the time 2000 AD had started putting part of the Dan Dare story on the cover. Yeah. But also, even when you look at the covers for Flesh, the covers for Judge Dredd, they're a lot more in keeping with the kind of action and battle, action-oriented one. But you look at Star-Lord, and they're by and large, well, almost exclusively painted covers, yeah, very much in that kind of almost European sci-fi tradition, like the kind of things you'd see on the front of an Isaac Asimov or an Arthur C. Clarke book. Do you think that was a help or a hindrance?
Well, I can only say from my point of view, it must have been a hindrance, because none of them really stand out in my mind. Mm. The same for the annuals as well. I mean, there was one of the annuals looked quite nice, but another one had like the Blake 7 spaceship on the front. And it's nothing that really, there wasn't anything really. I mean, you look at the 2000 E covers in that period, and that's a masterclass in how to sell comics to kids. Mm. I mean, they just literally jump off the shelf. They're so good. You can't help but want to kind of pick them up and have a flick through. And I can't recall ever getting that from a Star-Lord cover. Yeah.
I think the closest it came to my mind was the very yellow Robusters cover, where you've got Mechquake in his kind of killdozer guys, almost kind of bulldozering Rojors and Hammerstein. That's kind of the closest the two come. John, it sounds like...
And I've got to say, really good. I don't think the logo was as impressive as the 2000 E logo either.
Okay. Because they seem to be coming from the same kind of source, that kind of bold, kind of perspective-driven thing.
I don't know, the 2000 AD logo just looked so much more dynamic then. I know, you had the fluidity, the movement of it. It was just, smash, pow.
Yeah.
Star-Lord, it was nice, but it was just kind of there on the page.
John, you sounded like you wanted to say something just then.
Yeah, I mean, I think, obviously, we weren't aware of what was going on in the background, which obviously readers of 2000 AD and readers of Thrill Power Overload are more aware of now, that the original intent of Star-Lord was pretty much compromised by higher management, which is an ongoing story even today in some publishing, some comic publishers, where they don't have an understanding of what they're trying to achieve with the title. I mean, I think... Correct me if I'm wrong, but it wasn't the original intent that Star-Lord would be more of either a fortnightly or a monthly title. And so they had and looking at things like Mind Wars, which is a bit more high concept type science fiction, which rather than Timequake, which is sort of like a science fiction version of Dredger from Action. I think it's been compromised and then had to sort of like change course midway through its run to respond to the new frequency, and I think it suffered as a result of it. And as Matt knows from his own experience of publishing, of editing a weekly title, it's relentless. And I, you know, I did it when I was editing Overkill at Marvel UK, even though most of it was reprint. It's still a relentless and can be a treadmill thing without advanced planning and support from higher management to enable you to plan ahead 6 months in advance to get things commissioned well in advance to be sure of what you're trying to achieve with the title you've been given.
Mm. Matt, I mean, what's your take on them having taken Kelvin Gosnell off of 2000 AD? I think Nick Landau and Kevin O'Neill essentially ran it in his absence. But he was still meant to be keeping an eye on that. I mean, what's your perspective as an editor on two titles at the moment?
Yeah, I mean, basically, yeah, as soon as, if you take your eye off the ball with a weekly like 2000 AD, then you can run into problems. I can understand if an editor was taken off 2000 AD to shepherd something else but was meant to be keeping an eye on it, then you know things are gonna get sort of forgotten about and left behind, and you're gonna run into problems. But yeah, I mean, what John was saying about like the sudden change in frequency. I mean, it's the freelancers too had to really pick up the ball, because I think I'm right in saying the VCs was originally intended for Star-Lord. Mick McMahon was drawing the first episodes intended to be published over on a longer, you know, like 8 pages an episode on a twice weekly frequency, and then suddenly it got moved to 2000 AD, and suddenly it all had to be, you know, shortened to five pages an episode, but it had to come out every week. And so, you know, other artists have to be kind of drafted in to help out on that workload. So, these kind of changes that can be forced on a weekly comic can be a case of really sort of like running after your tail, really trying to. It's been described 2000 is like a sort of like one of those tankers that takes, you know, sort of 12 hours to change direction, you know, sort of thing. It's really these kind of changes aren't really something that you can just kind of sort of do on a whim.
Because something that Kelvin said in Thrill Power Overload was that he didn't actually really want to do Star-Lord, he reckons he'd been talked into it by John Sanders, who was the head guy there at the time. He says it was one of the biggest mistakes of my life, which is a hell of a thing to sort of realize while you're doing it, kind of thing. You know, you're not feeling particularly enthusiastic to begin with, but you've got to have the energy to do it. But other people are interfering. I mean, you know, if somebody came to you, Matt, and said, "Oh, 2000 AD's got to be twice weekly now," you'd have something to say about it.
No. Yeah, there's a certain degree of an editor being left alone on editing something like 2000 AD, because as soon as somebody starts coming in with their own ideas of what needs to be done, then you know, you just don't have the time to kind of like edit it by committee. You've got to kind of just kind of sort of get stuff out there, get stuff commissioned, and get it going. It would be demoralizing to be working on a title that you had no faith in and no interest in, and clearly that was felt with not just with Star-Lord but also Tornado as well, which was another thing that felt like was doomed from the start, because just again, it was kind of brought together by a committee and kind of like thrown out there in the hope that it would stick the way that previous comics had stuck, like Battle and 2000 AD, but again, didn't work out.
It almost seems, I get the sense of having read interviews with Kelvin, it almost felt vindictive that after, you know, having diverted him to launch one comic, they diverted him to launch another, and neither of them kind of succeeded in the way that 2000 AD had. Keith, I mean, do you think it was... I mean, let's talk about why Star-Lord only lasted 22 issues, because we've kind of touched on a few issues. Do you think there's one reason why Star-Lord, you know, was it the higher price point? Was it editorial interference? Was it the lack of...
I think the price point definitely comes into play. Yeah. then again, I also wonder, maybe, because a lot of people that I was at school with at the time that read comics, maybe it was just me, but I didn't really hang around with a bright bunch. So maybe a lot of people thought it was some kind of Marvel Guardians of the Galaxy spin-off.
Right.
Picked it up and were terribly disappointed and just didn't give it another chance.
John, what's your take on the reasons for it?
Well, I think if you look at sort of like things like the Star-Lord Summer Special, which was released in 1978, you get a small taste of what it could have been with a higher page count. And in some ways, it's sort of like more of a proto Judge Dredd magazine in that respect. I mean, although the strips within are again, a very mixed bag, I think there's a lack of consistency to Star-Lord that 2000 AD at the time really had. I mean, in 78, if you've got you're dealing with Cursed Earth, and Pat Mill was really cranking it out with that, which was that story, which was an incredibly long running marathon story, but was one people that I remember well coming back to read to find out what happened next, because it was such an epic, and I don't think that there's anything like that in Star-Lord, with the greatest respect to it. I mean, despite the talents involved, and you really have got a huge number of great writers and artists working on it, and the fact that Star-Lord was a great character, I think he doesn't really come into his own until he gets into 2000 AD. And I think that's the problem. And if you've got when you've got a situation where you do on the marketplace, you have got Star Wars Weekly, which was trouncing absolutely everything in terms of its sales numbers. Star-Lord is a brand. You've seen the rise at that, even at that point, of the brands of that are related to film and TV over the brands that the comics companies IPC and DC Thompson had created and had so much success since the 1930s. There's no level playing field anymore. If you're trying, I mean, 2000 AD being a wonderful, notable exception, if you were trying to launch a title today like Star-Lord, you'd want to have something in there that had some sort of TV or film tie-in to really have any hope of selling it, not just to the potential readership, but to the distributors as well. And that is and Keith mentioned that he couldn't find Star-Lord in his local newsagents, and that's always a perennial problem for anything that's just started. If you can't find the second issue, you stop reading.
Of course, on the point you made about the sort of tie-in stuff, 2000 AD had Dan Dare. And purposefully had Dan Dare because Pat wanted to give it the best chance that it could. I mean, I sometimes wonder whether the elements that are cited for Star-Lord being a more quality product, so like paperweight, more colour, things like that, did they actually matter to kids at the time? You know, if you're being asked to shell out a few extra pence out of your pocket money, does it actually matter that the paper's slightly thicker than you know, 2000 AD? What you're after is the stories, really, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. At that point, I think comics, I mean, although it's a collector's market now, it certainly wasn't then. And people, you know, for the most part, people would just pick them up, read them, and trade them. You know, they'd swap them with their mates, and you know, have you read this? It's a good comic. You might like Strontium Dog. And 2008, people regularly swap comics between them. It was far more throwaway than it is today. When you're shelling out quite a large amount of money for a weekly comic or even a monthly comic, it's still, you're going to keep hold of it.
I mean, I'd agree. I'd say that the publisher trying to put out a European style comic with, you know, color pages and aiming for a slightly older audience didn't do any favors. I think the kids didn't respond to it because it's slightly more expensive and they wanted more and more, you know, they wanted this disposable bog paper stuff because it was cheaper. I think maybe it was a sign that the UK wasn't ready for a slightly more prestige comic at the time. I think possibly, obviously, you know, the entire market's changed 40 years later, but
It's also a sign of how good the market was, though. I mean, when it came out, there was already good comics out there that it was like vying for shelf space with and trying to get pocket money out of the kids. It was, like you said, you already had 2000 AD. It was over 2 years old by then, plus all the comics we had imported. So, it was up against some stiff competition. Also, did Star-Lord get a television advertising campaign like 2000 AD?
I think it did, yes.
Oh, right, okay.
Because I'm not 100% on that one, but I'm sure that if we ever dig around YouTube, we'll find it somewhere.
Because I clearly remember seeing the 2000 AD advert on TV and getting a bit excited, but I don't ever recall seeing the Star-Lord ad.
Yeah, I mean, TV advertising certainly helps. I mean, I'm assuming there has been a knock-on effect from the fact that Hachette had really plugged the 2000 AD Ultimate Collection, and I'm assuming that has helped people go and actually, hopefully, gone out to look for 2000 AD now. And certainly, all the comics, because they had the budget, because the print runs were so huge, they had the money, the budget to do TV advertising. Whereas now, it's quite expensive, and most of your promotions tend to be retail based rather than consumer based.
Oh, it's I find it interesting that when they finally merged, I mean, it was Prog 86 in October 1978 when the two finally merged. Good news for all readers. We're scrapping your favorite comic and merging into another one. But John Sanders said that after the merger, what normally happened with the mergers is you'd get a big spike where the readers from the old from the cancelled comic would come over, but then it would tail off as they would drop away. But he was saying that 2000 AD circulation began to climb from that spike weirdly, which he'd never sort of seen in years of the kind of hatching, matching, and dispatching. I mean, is that just proof? More proof if we needed it that 2000 AD had got the formula right, whereas Star-Lord, you know, hadn't quite got there.
Yeah, doesn't John Sanders say that he was of a mind to cancel 2000 AD and Star-Lord going? Yeah. There was something about 2000 AD that swayed him in keeping.
Wait, he says it was a hunch.
Yeah.
To fold it into 2000 AD, because he said everyone should know just how close 2000 AD was to death before that merger, after comparatively few issues, which is terrifying.
I mean 2000 AD has dodged a fair few bullets in its time. There's a certain amount of luck that it's managed to keep going, but clearly there is a spirit there in Tharg and in 2000 AD that wasn't there in Star-Lord and I think the strength of the characters that came over with the merger encourage people to keep picking it up. Maybe people that, you know, that never picked up Star-Lord particularly loved Strontium Dog. And I would say that the strip certainly improved and grew from when it went into 2000 AD, and the story's got better, definitely.
It's scary to think that if 2000 AD could have folded into Star-Lord, what would have gone over? Probably would have been Mac 1 and Flesh.
Yeah, cool. Because, you know, and along with Dan Dare, they were the popular ones in those first couple of years, weren't they? So poor old Dredd.
You never know.
Yeah. How bizarre. Well, I kind of want to, before we start talking about Strontium Dog and Roadbusters, one of the things I wanted to get your opinions on was what this did for 2000 AD. You know, it didn't just bring across a couple of good series, because the Prog 86, the merger effectively ended Ant Wars and Inferno, which had been causing some problems editorially for 2000 AD. And Robo Hunter and Dan Dare went on hiatus for a hefty 14 weeks. Was this effectively an injection of freshness into the title? You know, was it that Star-Lord brought more with it than people realise, rather than just kind of like two good series? It also kind of just freshened things up a little bit.
I mean, it sounds management mandated that the Star-Lord strips had to start in that issue, which knocked two others out for about three months or so.
Yeah.
I mean, today if a new strip had to come in, I'd at least try and wait for a strip to finish before you bring in a new one. So that suggests that when IPC decided to bring in this comic, it had to they had to start in this issue, which isn't ideal. But it was of a time when that sort of thing could happen, and you wouldn't necessarily lose readers because of it.
Yeah, John, what's your take?
Well, most of the Hatch, Match, and Dispatch titles tended to last around 22 issues. I mean, if you look at, I mean, Thunder is an example. Another title that I read is in the early 70s, and that was dispatched ruthlessly after 22. Tornado was dispatched after 22. There seems to be, I would imagine that the editors might have expected that the merger was coming. But it's actually funny, if you actually look at the covers that when the merger happens, that you can see that there's an impact, because clearly they recognise that Hammerstein's a great looking character. He's on the cover of issue Prog 88. You've got Dredd as well, but Strontium Dog rapidly and Hammerstein in quick succession appear on 90 and 91. You've got they clearly helped, and I think it's another two strong sets of characters that helped ensure 2000 AD's ongoing success and drive it to ensure that people who bought it then are still buying it now in some ways. I mean, obviously you want to get new readers as well, but it's a they clearly had an impact and were clearly helped 2000 AD's ongoing success.
Well, let's talk about Robusters for a start. If you pass over the great stories of Robusters in 2000 AD, it helped launch the ABC Warriors. You've got Nemesis being part of that world. You've also now got Invasion Savage being part of that world as well, but the big Mills verse. What did Robusters do for 2000 AD?
I'd say that in Road Jaws and Hammerstein, they had a double act that kind of acted as a backup icons for the strip for Tharg, really. Because away from Tharg doing the Nerve Center, you had Road Jaws doing his own book review and film review page.
Yeah, of course. Yeah,
and there'd be these little comedy. Gags between Road Jaws and Hammerstein, and so to that point, you had these pair of funny characters that and robots were big. Mm. I think in the late 70s, I think everyone was suddenly into robots.
It was perfect timing for a robotic duo to come along after R2-D2 and C-3PO arrived on the scene in Star Wars, so it just made complete sense, really. Quite a canny move by Pat Mills.
Yeah, well, it's interesting that two of the characters were folded into the editorial remit as well. I mean, I know Tharg has had his strips published within 2000 AD, but to have those two characters pop out and talk directly to readers, that's, I mean, well, we've
I've
not really done that, have we? Apart from
this,
Vector 13.
I've only done this a fraction of times. Yeah. I feel badly for Matt, because writing Tharg speak is bloody difficult. I mean, I'd have much more fun, you know, writing a Road Jaws or a Hammerstein. So I'm not surprised they had more of an editorial voice. And when you look at like the editorial at the time, I don't think there were a lot of Tharg fans around the late 70s. Mm. I know Pat's certainly not a big fan. I know he's gone by then, but I know he wasn't a big fan of Tharg either. They just add a bit of levity to the comic. I know, as funny as Tharg is, but it's so difficult to get his voice.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, in terms of the strip, you know, Robusters in Star-Lord have been one thing, but there is a noticeable change, a kind of upping of the tempo when it enters 2000 AD. And you know, before long, you end up with the ABC Warriors. Do you think Pat was responding to that shift in the venue of the strip?
Yeah, possibly. I mean, without trying to be rude to the artist and Star-Lord, I think the art improved when it went over to 2000.
Yeah, well, of course, Dave Gibbons
doing it. Yeah, and then Mick McMahon did most of the big final arc, the fall and rise of Road Jaws and Hammerstein.
Hmm.
I think the stories in, I mean, Ian Kennedy did some Star-Lord stories in
That's right. Yeah.
I mean, he's obviously a great artist, but his art is slightly eaglish, and it belongs to sort of a slightly earlier era.
Yeah.
And obviously he did Dan Dev when the New Eagle started in the early 80s. But a lot of the art in the Star Lord stories felt slightly a little bit archaic, and then suddenly in 2000 with the likes of Dave Gibbons and Mick, you had these sort of young up and comers who were injecting this kind of punk energy that they'd already done when Dave had done Dan Dare and Mick had done Dread. I think they improved.
Yeah, but point. I think the transfer was also a great time for Pat to be able to shake it up a bit. I think the initial idea was that the Roadbusters were a little bit like the Thunderbirds.
Yeah.
And by the late 70s, the Thunderbirds were getting a little bit stale. And, you know, so it gave Pat the perfect opportunity to go, well, let's kind of, that original concept, I can kind of move away from that slightly, and here's the perfect opportunity.
John, I mean, what's your take? Because obviously we've mentioned Dave Gibbons, and I think Dave's on record as saying, you know, it was after having done Dan Dare, Roadbusters was a nice change of pace.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, if you look at, I mean, the issues that are coming out just with the merger, you've got Dave working on he's working on Dread and on Roadbusters in there, so it would give the impression that Dave was virtually drawing the entire comic to some people, but obviously he wasn't. But it just looks stronger. I mean, it just looks stronger. There's a clear direction to 2000 AD with these issues, and it's really riding high with the artwork, with the stories. You've got Flesh to double pay, you know, in the center pages. The lineup's just terrific, and I would assume that Roadbusters went darker because it was then in 2000 AD, and you want to make the changes because that's the approach that 2000 AD took. I mean, you mentioned earlier that Star-Lord was a bit more bloody, but I think 2000 AD has a strong sense of energy to it, of violence that's fairly apparent all the way through. You know, people getting eaten by dinosaurs and things like that. And as I said, Strontium Dog just simply adds to the lineup. I can see why you would want to buy this comic if you're a science fiction fan, especially, you know, it really is a nice tonic compared with the sort of a more anodyne Star Wars Weekly.
Well, there's one of the reasons why Roadbusters is important at this phase is because it kind of solidified something stifled something that was beginning to become a real issue for comics and still is an issue today. Because Mills recounts selling only the first British serial rights to Roadbusters after a verbal agreement with, I think, John Sanders, Kelvin Gosnell. And that was nipped in the bud fairly early on. But what a different world this would have been if that had continued, because 2000 AD, having, you know, only really just introduced credit boxes for the first time, the idea of then things, you know, the strips themselves being, you know, only licensed by the creators for serial rights. I mean, that the history of British comics would have been very different if that had persisted.
I think maybe that was a case of IPC not realising what they had, and, you know, thinking that 2000 might be as disposable as some of the other comics that had been and gone, and that you'd never see the contents of it again, because, you know, collections of this stuff didn't exist. You know, they weren't reprinted elsewhere, as far as I know. We will just sell the British serial rights for the first story. That's never going to get ever going to appear again.
Yeah,
but of course, you know, these stories have been in numerous reprint albums and still on the shelf today. Yeah.
Because, I mean, also, let's not forget that IPC were a global company. I mean, we're still digging up translations of strips in Tamil and you know, other sort of far flung languages. So the idea that they couldn't then, even though graphic novels hadn't really become, you know, the collections hadn't really become a thing by that point, not being able to repurpose this artwork for foreign editions must have absolutely terrified them as well. Yeah. I mean, Keith, what do you think the impact would have been if that agreement with Pat had stood at the time?
Wow. I don't know. Who knows? Who knows? I can't answer that one, to be honest.
Okay. John, what's your feeling on it?
Well, I think it's sort of, I mean, even now, the fact that you've got an extra licensing issue with a title. For example, if you've sublicensed the use of covers on a comic, and then the license department finds out they can't use those covers because they were first rights only, it causes administration problems for a well-oiled machine that was used to just having the material and being able to sell it anywhere. So the creator rights aside, the fact that it made it more complicated for some bean counter in a small office in IPC to actually sell that material would have kicked up ructions, and unfortunately and very sadly the creators were ridden roughshod over, and there was that whole thing about all rights buyout. I mean, even at Marvel UK, when Marvel UK tried to go the route of Vertigo with the issue with Strip magazine, once they realised that some strips could actually be quite popular, they started to try and renege on their agreements with creators to over rights and try and claim that that they owned them after all. It's an ongoing issue, isn't it, with creators' rights? But yeah, certainly
within very choppy waters.
Yeah,
very choppy waters. But that said, I mean, I've always felt in some ways that that if you've already got a deal, for example, if you're licensing, say, Ghostbusters, inevitably you've got a system in place to pay the people who own Ghostbusters a licensing fee on top of as part of the sales of the title. So therefore, there's no reason why a publisher shouldn't be able to actually swap out its formula for paying a licensor of Ghostbusters for licensing the use of characters from an individual creator. It does make it more complicated. Once you have the system in place, then it wouldn't be. But it's just a matter of biting the bullet and deciding, yeah, look, we're going to treat creators right, and we're going to make sure you get a fee if we reprint your strip. And that's what Rebellion do, which is all to the credit of the company.
Well, let's move on to talk about Strontium Dog, my favourite of the strips that came across from Star-Lord, because it was quite a mad strip when it first started in Star-Lord. You know, you've got that incredibly kind of organic Carlos Esquerda artwork. It's very much riffing off Westerns, but with lots of other elements in as well. And then it comes into 2000 AD and it begins to morph into something a little grittier, a little sort of starker. One thing that I did want us to discuss is the fact that Strontium Dog brought back Carlos Esquerda. This is probably the most enduring legacy of Star-Lord on the prog is that it brought back the creator of Dread, because he'd gone off because he was upset that the first published story of Dread had been the one drawn by Mick McMahon. What did this mean for the future of 2000 AD, having Carlos back and happy to be back as well?
Certainly you had one of the best and most prolific artists working in British comics. It was a boon. He's incredibly popular as well as being good and fast. It was a definite plus from an editor's point of view that you've got this incredibly consistent artist on your books.
I mean, obviously, he then begins to draw Dread again. We eventually have the Apocalypse War, which is his full return to Judge Dread. I mean, let's return to a what if. You know, would Dread have ever been as strong if it hadn't have been Esquerda and Wagner working together? Are they a partnership that riffs off each other?
Yes, I mean they clearly enjoy working together. Carlos likes John's scripts because they leave him alone to do what he wants to do, what he does best.
Yeah.
You know, they don't try and tell him what to draw. And John likes Carlos because he draws what's in the script, and his storytelling is second to none. And you know, he's great at creating characters. That period in sort of like the early to mid 80s when you had Wagner Grant and Carlos on both Dread and Strontium Dog is an incredibly strong period, and it's got a great energy to those stories. So I think to that degree, yeah, we do owe Star-Lord a certain amount of gratitude for bringing Carlos back.
Because that strong period you mentioned, that's kind of like the adolescence of 2000 AD. You know, it had moved beyond a lot of the influences and the audience. The audience was growing up with it to a certain extent. So, you know, can we say that without that injection from Star-Lord, not just of Carlos, but of the strips like Strontium Dog and the audience as well, that it clearly brought with it, because you had the spike and then you had the increasing readership. Do you think 2000 AD would have been as strong? Would it have survived?
I think it would have survived. I think it wouldn't have had so much character possibly without that injection. Maybe it would have found these things eventually elsewhere. You know, maybe Carlos would have come back through another route to Dread. It certainly didn't do 2000 any harm. Star-Lord coming in unlike Tornado, which is a right barrel of rubbish. Star-Lord was an injection of quality, I'd say.
Keith, what's your feeling about the way that Strontium Dog came in and the way it evolved? Because, I mean, you know, you look at the kind of fantastical stuff that you've got sort of in the early days, and then you end up with pure Western. I mean, something like the Bubba Gang and Rage, which was the follow-up, all the way through to like the late 80s stuff. This is pure kind of Deadwood style, Man Without a Name kind of Westerns.
I mean, I'll be honest, I wasn't a massive fan of Strontium Dog in Star-Lord. And that includes, you know, Carlos is obviously a fantastic, amazing artist. But the art style was it looked a bit looser, slightly more cartoony in Star-Lord. Dare I say, it looked like he was kind of deliberately aiming it at a younger readership.
All right, okay.
I think it really benefited that, you know, when Strontium Dog ended up in 2000 AD and Carlos was working on Dread as well, I think, you know, working on those two simultaneously, you know, he kind of just developed that kind of gritty style that he put on Dread. He kind of applied that to Strontium Dog as well, and I think that worked wonders. Definitely came into his own. It looked gorgeous, and I think it even supplanted Dread for long periods of time as the number one character in the comic. So that definitely a massive benefit, him coming back.
Yeah. John, what do you think was the benefit of Strontium Dog coming into the prog?
Well, it's Strontium Dog, because consistency. Carlos Esquerra is, unlike Judge Dredd, despite the quality of, you know, McMahon and people like that working on Dredd, Esquerra is drawing pretty much every episode of, in fact, did you draw every episode of Strontium Dog in 2000 AD for quite a long time? And there's a consistency to the strip that really gives it a strength that you don't have perhaps with the rival characters. I mean, you've got wonderful things like Pat Mills working with Mike Dorey on Robusters, you know, with there's the Prog 93. You've got Rojals waking up in bed with some tramp millionaire he's met, which is a great laugh. But I mean, for true consistency and for building that backbone and the strength of 2000 AD, I don't think there's any doubt that Strontium Dog plays a massive part in ensuring that building of, horrible word, brand, which is so important compared with other comics that have long gone.
Well, unfortunately, because Strontium Dog did survive, we did eventually get the Strontium Dog Arena computer game, which was awful, and I still want my money back for that.
How much did that cost you? £3?
That was a lot of money back then.
Yeah,
could have got me all sorts of sherbet dips.
Well, let's round this out with a talk about Star Lord's legacy. You know, it's 40 years since it merged 2000 AD. What do we think is the thing that marks out its legacy, its impact on 2000 AD of all the things that we've talked about, Matt?
It's the two characters that gave 2000 AD that have been the two long lasting characters. Strontium Dog and Roadbusters have been incredibly important additions to the lineup, and their popularity endures even 40 years later.
Keith, do you think that Kelvin Gosnell gets enough credit for being behind this shot in the arm for 2080?
Not really. No, he certainly deserves it. But you know, what you just said to Matt. I mean, Matt's kind of summed it up. I mean, the legacy is those two strips that just made 2080 even more important and strong. And the amount of fantastic stories that those two strips have generated over the years, it's been so brilliant. You look at stuff like the Terramex or, you know, the Max Bubba storyline. Mm. I mean, they're now considered classic stories, classic British comic book stories, and they might not have existed, weren't Star-Lord folded, and they made their way into 2000 AD.
Mm. John, what's your final thoughts?
Strontium Dog, for one, and the fact that you aren't running ragged the editorial department on 2000 AD stroke what was Star-Lord, and you've meant they can focus on one title, so it means that you're not stretching the obvious talents across two, not knowing where one was going, because the management didn't know what to do with it. And that all that behind the scenes stuff where it enabled those guys to focus on 2080 definitely helps the product. And it was already looking fantastic, but with that arrival of those characters in Star-Lord, there seems to be a shot in the arm, and it's got looking through the issues that follow the merger, it just has a real power to it that it perhaps didn't quite have before, because you know, you've ditched Dan Dare, for example, which was always a little bit, although I enjoyed Bernard and Ellie's work, it always sat a bit uneasily in 2000 AD. I know he comes back later and Dave Gibbons has a great run on him, but these are characters that have been created that seem to just fit in the 2000 AD ethos to me. Mm. And worked to its benefit, because as you say, Robust is these two ABC Warriors, which is just superb.
Brilliant. Well, guys, we've run out of time, so I'd like to thank Matt and Keith for joining me in the booth, and to John for joining us on Skype, and tune in next time, Earthlits, for another episode of the 2000 AD Thrillcast. And like I said, we're going to be interviewing Kelvin Gosnell about his time, not just on Star-Lord, but also on 2000 AD in a future episode, so look forward to that.
Any Tornado episodes coming up?
Maybe. Until next time, Earthlits, Splendid Verthrig.
Alert! 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 Fell power levels dangerously high. Alert! Alert! Read 2000 AD every week. Ask your comic book store or newsagent now. Subscribe to the galaxy's greatest comic at 2000adonline.com. Subscribe digitally on our apps for Apple, Android, and Windows 10. And download DRM free copies from 2000adonline.com. Alert! Alert! Stand by for urgent updates. Search for 2000AD on Twitter and Facebook. Watch the latest videos at youtube.com/2000ADonline. And follow on Instagram at Insta2000AD. Program complete. Shutting down.